All right, welcome, Robert. So, I think I just found Robert's book somewhere on maybe Facebook in a chat with other people who care about the registry, I think. I saw the book, and I think there was a way for me to reach out. So I think I reached out to you through Facebook and said, this book sounds like something that we would like to hear more about. And then we had a brief phone call conversation. But beyond that, this is my first time meeting him. So welcome, Robert, and
Thank you.
we're very excited to hear all of the things that you know about due process and post-conviction justice. The number of times that I get calls from someone who says, oh, well, when I signed my plea deal, they said this, and now all of a sudden they're saying this completely different thing. Like, how is that legal? We don't know. We would like to hear
Exactly.
this all about it.
We'll definitely talk about that. Can everyone hear me good?
Yes.
I've got you two guys. I don't know about everybody else if they can hear me or not.
Again.
Okay, perfect. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank Miss Ann for inviting me to speak here tonight before everyone. And I'm going to talk about my book a little bit and some issues in the criminal justice system that you'll find that is relative to a lot of issues I know that you guys normally speak about. Okay. So I want to speak about failures of due process. Our criminal justice system, innocence, and the illusion of law as it is today. Okay. For some of you in here, this may come as a shocker, but what many of you or maybe your loved ones have been through or experienced isn't what I would call justice today. Criminal justice system is a two-way street. Everybody thinks, criminal justice is law enforcement, is, court of law in your respective jurisdictions. It's not all about the prosecution. Justice can, it's like I said, it's a two-way street. Someone can be prosecuted, someone can be acquitted, or found, not guilty and released. That's still justice. Okay. I think a lot of things today, social media and, Hollywood movies that are out kind of portrays our criminal justice systems to be something that necessarily it is not. Does everyone maybe somewhat agree with that?
Yes, that television is nonsense.
Yeah.
That a lot of time what we see on television is not.
Everybody in here, if you want to interact, I definitely feed off of you, and that kind of builds me up. So if you, I know some of you might be nervous to speak, but if you'd like to, feel free to jump in there. I don't mind being cut off. Okay.
I think most of them will be automatically muted. And so,
Okay.
if they want to say something, they just got to say raise hand. So you go to the react
Oh,
section,
okay.
and one of the sections under the react section says raise hand. So 100%, I'll
Oh,
be
perfect.
watching. If
Okay,
you raise
thanks,
your hand,
Ann.
you kind of move to the top of the list.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if you could help me monitor that because I might get going and not realize that that's working there.
Yeah, I will watch for raised
Okay.
hands, and I'll watch for questions in the chat, so you don't have
And
to read either of those.
I will have a time for questions at the end. I have that here. Okay, so in our world today, it's not necessarily justice, what people are going through. Our criminal justice system always claims fairness, but I can tell you that it's not always fair. You know this as well. But it too often delivers something very different. Okay, I've spent years in investigations. I started off in the military. I was an investigator in the Army. Investigated cybercrime and espionage, if anybody knows what that is. Essentially, that's individuals stealing classified information and giving it to, necessarily people who shouldn't have it or are enemies. So it's a real serious matter. A lot of that I can't even speak about, but I can tell you that part. I was federal law enforcement for many years, and now I do post-conviction in investigations, or better known as habeas corpus. Does anybody in here know what habeas corpus is?
I'm supposed to know that, but no.
Okay. Ken, do you know what habeas corpus is, sir? I can't hear him. I think he's muted.
You can.
Thank you. Habeas corpus is the right to, shoot. I'm sorry. I
Give
wish
him a
I
hint.
remember.
Give him a little hint.
And it's okay. So
I do
habeas
know,
corpus
but I
actually.
forget. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me.
Okay. Yeah, the habeas corpus actually is Latin, which is, a lot of our laws are based from the very first democracy in Greek or Greece rather, and then later in Rome. So it's Latin for "we have the body." And you may ask me, what does that have to do with post-conviction investigations? But it actually is broken down, and it is the requirement for relief for individuals under the law if it is so necessary. So if someone has been wrongfully in prison for something they didn't do 30 years ago, and now we have science, forensics that figure out, hey, this individual didn't commit this crime, habeas corpus takes over in the form of a writ. You ever heard of the great writ? The great writ of habeas corpus. So essentially, it's just like any other motion that's filed in the state courts. If the states don't agree with it, it can be taken all the way to the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C., where they decide upon if someone is actually guilty or not and if they should be released. So that in a nutshell is habeas corpus, or in layman's terms, post-conviction, because it is an investigation that takes place after conviction.
Oh, so
Post.
habeas corpus
Okay.
only refers to post-conviction stuff?
You can file for habeas corpus while you're awaiting trial, while you're in custody, and let's say you're in the county jail. It can come in any form of relief. Say an individual, needs the doctor, but the correctional officers aren't taking them to the doctor. A motion of habeas corpus can be filed where a judge can order, like, hey, that's in violation of this, this, and that. I can tell you there are state and federal laws that are in place that ensures that someone can be taken to the doctor. That is a really small example. Most of the time in my realm, what we see is someone gets a retrial or a vacator, meaning that all the charges, the conviction is wiped away. An individual goes home, and some state here in the United States owes an individual a lot of money for wrongful imprisonment. I'm sure you've seen that on TV shows before, perhaps. Okay, so I've seen cases from the inside out. I worked on this on the law enforcement side. That has given me perspective where I used to be, running investigations as an active agent in the field, to on this side of habeas corpus, where I'm doing review of transcripts of the court, police reports to ensure law enforcement, judges, defense attorneys, prosecutors are doing what they're supposed to be doing under the law. Does that make sense to everyone? I've spoken to families, just like you, people that's, maybe affected, that's in your family, that were told, hey, trust the system. The truth will come out. Everything was done properly. You have nothing to worry about. But when you actually go back and you look carefully, you start to see something else. Would everyone agree with me on that? Start to see things that maybe you didn't see the first time or when you were in the court experiencing it. Okay. You start to see things like missing evidence, suppression of evidence. Does everybody in here realize that suppression of evidence is called a Brady violation? Has anybody ever heard of a Brady violation? So there was a gentleman that his case went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. His last name was Brady. So therefore, the name of the federal case presidents is named after the individual. So essentially, the federal courts at the highest level said that prosecutors cannot suppress evidence, even if it is, more in the way that it helps the defensive side of the courtroom. So essentially, just because they don't like a piece of evidence doesn't mean they can hide it from
Yeah, and
the
isn't
other
it true
side.
that they're required to give all of their stuff to the defense?
Exactly. That is called a Brady disclosure. It has to be disclosed to the other side.
So in the
Okay.
Brady guy's
So
case, they had not given him what he was supposed to, and that's when it
exactly.
started.
Exactly.
Oh.
Exactly. So in the post-conviction world, every case that we have, we can find issues in the case, and they are going to be relative to a federal court precedent. A case like this that has already occurred, when we can draw those lines together and present it in the writ, that's where, courts start going on the defensive side instead of the prosecutorial side. Does that make sense? We can always relate a case to an issue because, we've been a country for a little more than 250 years now. And what's interesting about the way our law is written is that it is ever evolving, ever changing. We as a people, as a grand community, the law is designed to evolve as we progress. The law is based upon multiple things. Our Bill of Rights is a direct derivative of the Ten Commandments. Many people don't know that. Our laws come from the Bible. You can say that those are from the Quran or the Torah or any other cultural difference throughout the world have similar laws. But typically, history books will tell you this, that our law is a derivative from English common law, which is, since we were a colony of Great Britain, that we our law comes from English common law. And a little fun fact, if you didn't know, English common law to this day is not written. It is just a spoken law. Isn't that interesting? So
Really?
somebody has to keep up with that. Now, without saying this, there are people who have written it into books, right? Recorded it. But as the government goes, there is no official copy of the law in England. And that is where our laws come from. You look at their government, a two-house parliament. We call it Congress. We have a two-house Congress. Everything, our way our government is set up is very similar to them. Okay. All right. So we're talking about how the system is telling everyone, like, you don't have anything to worry about. You don't have to worry. Everything's going to come out. But we all know that it's not necessarily true. We talked about suppression of evidence and we learned what a Brady violation is. You start to see law enforcement, prosecutors, judges, defense attorneys cutting corners. Has anybody in here had a defense attorney that you felt they didn't do what they were supposed to do, that they were cutting corners? I would probably guess a lot of people in here can relate to that. Okay. You know what's interesting about that? That is another federal constitutional violation. It's called Strickland. It is a Strickland violation. There is a two-pronged test that the Supreme Court set under Strickland to ensure that attorneys are representing their defendant in a purposeful way. If something needs to be investigated, it's being looked into. If they need to go and visit an individual in jail, that's being done. They're listening. They have a meaningful defense that is put together in a timely manner before trial, before plea negotiations. You brought up pleas earlier. They'll think this is a good time to talk about plea negotiation. Does everyone realize that in this country, 90% of criminal cases that go before the court, and it always ends in a plea negotiation? Why do you think that is? Somebody tell me, why do you think that is?
I think it's because they have gotten the laws get stricter and stricter because we've been, having this tough on crime phase for 30 years. And so they can pretty much say, well, if you don't sign this plea deal, you might get, 60 years, you might get 30 years, you might get, they threaten you with way
Exactly.
more than the plea. And so you're like, well, I guess I better take the
So,
plea.
Ann, what do you call that when an attorney is telling them, hey, if you don't sign this, you're going to get more time. You better sign this because the judge is going to be mad at you. What is that called?
To me, it feels like a threat.
It
I don't
is
know
a
if there's a
threat,
name for it.
but the law has a word for it. It's called coercion.
Oh, well,
It's
it happens all the
coercive. I've
time.
seen it
It
does.
happens all
John,
the
I think I've
time.
seen a gentleman named John raise his hand.
Yes, let me go find John.
She's
Unmute.
coming, John.
Hey, there we
There
go.
he is.
Good evening. Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
The coercion that you talked about, right on the money. My own defense attorney pointedly said two things. Number one, my job is only to defend you. It is not my job to prove you are innocent. And the other thing that he said, and this is what, again, ultimately compelled me to make my own plea bargain. No matter what witnesses, no matter what documents, no matter what experts that you bring into the court, a jury is going to find you guilty no matter what.
I have heard this all too many times. Mr. Ken, I'm going to get to you, and let me put this part in here before I forget it, okay? So under Strickland, when you're being coerced, a plea deal. And, I don't know if anybody of it, I'm sure John has seen it, but a, plea packet, pretty big stack of paper. Under the law, your attorney is required to explain that from A to Z of what that plea deal is. Okay, so everybody in here probably knows that a lot of individuals don't understand what they're being talked to about, if they're being told anything at all. Okay, y'all think about, I'm not saying anybody in this room, but you think about America as a whole. We have a lot of individuals that are illiterate, can't read and write still. I have people come in my office all the day that still sign their name with an X, So how are you supposed to, make them understand clearly what they're signing? The law says that a plea must be willingly signed and agreed upon. There must be a knowledge of knowing and understanding of what the plea is. And the court is required another part. Once a plea is agreed upon, all parties go back into court, right? And the judge has the individual stand up and say, I'm going to use Mr. Ken just for a second. They're going to say, Mr. Ken, will you please stand up? Do you understand this plea? And all they are looking for is yes or no. And as soon as you say yes, the court reporter has typed your answer. And guess what, folks? It has become final. There is nothing at that point you can do as far as the conviction goes. But again, that's where post-conviction comes in, where we can prove that you did not knowingly and willingly, or maybe you were even coerced to sign a plea deal that you did not understand. Guess what that gets you? If a judge agrees in an appellate court or higher, all the way to the Supreme Court, there are multiple levels, and we can talk about that here in a minute. If a judge also finds in favor of that, that you did not understand or you were coerced, that plea is wiped away. You're all taken back down to the trial court, and it all starts all over again. Mr. Ken.
Yes, unmute.
Thank you. I certainly did. I was told by attorneys that plea bargains were not appealable, so I'm happy to hear this. But to me, the 90%, or what I've heard in federal courts, 93%, are simply to keep the courts from being overwhelmed. A plea bargain is
Exactly.
one day, whereas a trial is a week or a month, and there's no way our judicial system is set up to handle everybody if
You're
they
exactly right.
bargains.
I'm going to
Yeah, and
share, Ken.
I just put a thing in
Go
the
ahead,
chat
Ann.
about a shortage of public defenders. So you
That's
add
true.
overwhelmed courts and a shortage of public defenders.
There
And
are many factors.
one person has his hand up, and I told him I'd call on him next time you have a free minute.
Okay, go ahead.
Jim. Okay, so hang on, I gotta find Jim. Well, finish your next sentence, because now I gotta find it. Because
Sure. Well,
when they raise their hand, it's easy. When they don't raise their hand, you gotta like look hard.
another more factors that I want to point out, on top of a shortage, of court-appointed attorneys, public defenders, is why do you think prosecutors are so quick to want to promote a plea bargain? Let me spin something for you. Have you ever thought that maybe they didn't have a good case or enough evidence to convict you? Let that sink in. Why do you think they rush and then they start their coercion business? And don't get it twisted. Prosecutors know these attorneys that are representing people within a local jurisdiction. They know each other. Heck, they might even went to law school together. You know what I mean? So, and then another aspect is, and I think this is one of the biggest ones, is that prosecutors, they still see plea negotiations as a number on a piece of paper. They always want to get high percentage of a conviction rate. They still count that as a conviction rate, or it goes as a factor to, equate into a conviction rate. But another thing is your local jurisdictions, the states that you may live in, they don't want to spend the money. They don't want to spend the money. They can't afford it. Can you imagine it if every criminal or every crime that happened in America went to a full trial where a jury is called, and the extensiveness, the length in it part, every trial, there's trials can last a day, 2 days, some can last 2 years or more. They can't afford it. They can't do it. I guess we can go ahead and take the next
Okay,
person there.
Jim, I unmuted, or I asked you to unmute because it wouldn't let me in, but you're up, Jim. No, can't unmute. Oh, there we go.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, I got a question to ask you. Is there a limit as far as time is concerned to do anything with your case? It's my understanding that once you're off of your parole or whatever out of prison, you can't do anything. But there is a fine line between being on the registry and still being in custody. So that's
Oh,
kind of my
sure.
question.
Well, I will tell you this, there is no timeline for habeas corpus. So it can be filed at any time. I knew that was going to be a question. I even put it on my document here for the end. A lot of people will ask me, what does a registry have to do with post-conviction? Well, it has everything to do with a post-conviction case. Does everyone in here realize that if you win a habeas corpus case, especially if you're an individual that think they're innocent and you hold true to that, and you have evidence, or there can be evidence found to show that you're innocent, that registry goes away, folks.
Well,
That's
that's
part
one
of
of
it.
the big things for me is the innocence, and I've said that and screamed that for, well, 33 years. I was convicted in
Yep.
93, and
Sure.
so nobody's listening. And the, as
I
far as
understand.
I'm concerned, the attorney I had was less than good, and I actually paid this
Yeah.
guy, and we went to jury trial. The prosecutor offered me 12 years, and all I was actually got after a trial was 14. So I would have saved 2 years for pleading guilty to something I didn't do, and they didn't seem
Sure.
to understand that. As you probably know, a sex crime, you're automatically guilty until you prove otherwise, and.
Yeah, you're right. But I will tell you, I'll caveat off your original question, is there is no timeline. There are
Okay.
individuals that I have worked with that, they've already been to prison, and they've served their time and they're out on parole, or the parole has already ended. That could be for various different crimes, right? A big one is murder. But even though you've served your time, that's still going to always remain on your record, right? A lot of
Right.
people proceed, they go after, their case in post-conviction stage many years later, to get an expungement. Everybody knows what an expungement is, where it's
Correct.
stricken from your, essentially it's where, you can prove your innocence. But let me throw this out there. Everybody always thinks that you have to be absolutely innocent to file for post-conviction. That is not true. One thing to throw out there is habeas corpus is not just for innocents. Habeas corpus is also for individuals who are treated unfairly by the law. If the courts, prosecutor, law enforcement, that can be misconduct. You went to jail and they beat you up so bad you couldn't even stand up in court, to answer the judge's questions. There are numerous factors that goes in to make a case. And just because you might be guilty of something doesn't mean that you got a fair trial. I want everybody to remember that. Okay.
Do a lot of cases, like, what's the rate of people who ask for a habeas corpus post-conviction thing and get it versus not get it? Because I'm sure that what
About
any lawyer would say is, oh, it's going to cost you a bajillion dollars and your odds
it
are
does.
slim.
It does cost a lot. But I will say it varies state to state, and you also got to remember there are two different levels of habeas corpus motions. So you have the state level writs that are done, and then you can take it into the federal level. So those are two different sets of writs there. And within each jurisdiction, whether it's state or federal, there are multiple sub layers within those individual steps there. I can explain that to you how that works. So when someone files a writ, and let's say, so I'm in Texas. In Texas, the law is a little different than some states. A writ goes to what they call the appellate court or the court of appeals, right? A copy of it goes to the district court, which is the local court that you were convicted in. If the appellate court doesn't agree with you, you can refile it in the Texas Supreme Court. Okay. In states like California, they use different words like circuit court or superior court. It's all the same thing, pretty much. You just have to, know how to separate those, prospectively in your jurisdiction. But after the Texas Supreme Court, it goes to the first federal level. So that would be what the federal district you live in. Does everybody know that the United States is split up into 90 plus federal districts? Okay.
So you're telling me
each
even
one
if
of
your
those,
charge was a state charge, if your charge was a state charge, you could still go federal with an appeal?
Yes, you can. Because the Constitution allows federal oversight. Okay. So all these federal court case presidents that are being violated is a violation of federal law, right? So if the state is not adhering to federal law, you have the right to take your case up the ladder to those steps, right? For me, the first federal district is in Dallas, Dallas, Texas. Okay. If that federal judge agrees that you should not be, the conviction should not stand, they will issue an order. The state of Texas has no reason, they have no choice but to comply. They have to release you. Now they can counter it, they may try to counter it, trying to keep you in prison, right? If it fails at the first district level and at the federal side, you can take it up to the circuit federal level, which is where you start to see a panel of judges. I'm sure everybody remembers learning about the Supreme Court in social studies in school, how it's a panel. There's multiple judges that make up that court. So at the circuit federal level, it normally goes to what's called an en banc. An en banc. It's another Latin phrase. It normally is three federal judges at the circuit level, and they will look at the case. If they don't agree, you can take your case up to the full circuit level. It depends on what jurisdiction you're in. It might be six, it might be nine, it might be 12 justices at that level. If the circuit court does not agree with you on your case, the next step would be the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C. And folks, that's the end of the road. There's no higher court, in the United States. So if a lot of these cases, I'm sure you've seen on the news, like Roe versus Wade is a big one that, here recently about abortions. That was decided originally in the Supreme Court, and you've seen that it got overturned in Supreme Court because a lower court cannot overturn a case that has been decided upon in the past at the highest court in the world. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Miss Faye has a question. I hadn't heard from
Let's
her.
See that? Let me find Faye. Faye, why are you? Oh, there we go. Unmute. All right, you're on, Faye.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. What about a situation where it started federal in another state, like a sting or entrapment, and it's not enough for federal, so they send it to Florida for Florida to develop a case. Manufacture a case is what happened. And so can it still go? Do you start with federal in trying to appeal it,
okay,
or do you go state?
That is a good question. So if the conviction occurred in a state court, it has to go to the state court. And I want to throw in there something for you, Miss Faye. There are a lot of cases that do start out federal. Do you know why they sometimes end up back to the state?
Well, they
Have
said
you ever thought
it
about that?
No, but they said it wasn't enough evidence to prosecute federally. Mm-hmm. So they gave it to the state.
Well, I'll tell you, I don't like that answer that they give you. The law is the law across this country. Everybody in here realizes that law comes from our Constitution. And then we have other supplements to that, like United States Code that gives every law in the land, every state gets its laws from federal law. It's like a trickle down system. And then the state gives it to the counties, or if you're in Louisiana, the parishes, and then from the county level down to your district level, from district down to your city level, So it's a trickle down, the levels of government. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What I will tell you on federal cases like that, either they didn't want to deal with it, or let me tell you the number one reason the federal government likes to hand cases. Well, actually, there are two reasons they'd like to hand it back over to the state. Is one, they didn't have any jurisdiction, because everybody, I want you to understand that some crimes only the state has jurisdiction over, not the federal government. Now, the federal government will assist in enforcing it. The federal government will assist enforcing state laws as long as they are felonies. Okay? I'll throw this in there. The federal law enforcement have zero authority over state misdemeanors. Cannot enforce it. If you run a traffic sign in front of a federal agent, he cannot pull you over. Okay? That's a
Really?
misdemeanor. Okay? So another reason the federal government likes to hand cases back to the state for cases like drugs, sexual crimes, and killing, murder, the state generally has higher sentencing, meaning they can impose harsher punishment. And another thing to remember, the federal government does not have death penalty,
Doesn't have what?
only the states, death
Death.
penalties. Only the state governments have death penalty. So the main part of your question is does it go federal or state? If it was convicted, prosecuted at the state level, it has to go back to the state first. Then it has to work its way up the ladder, just like we discussed before, and eventually it will reach the federal government if it needs to. You have to
And if
understand.
you have enough money.
Yeah, exactly. You have to also understand that some cases don't have to go to the federal level. They can be corrected at a state level, whether it's at the Criminal Court of Appeals or whatever your equivalent is in your state, or the Texas Supreme Court, or
Well, I
whatever,
think,
again, whatever equivalent is in your state.
okay, I think we are a textbook case with the for the Brady list. I just discovered recently, after him being in prison 6 years, that there was a Brady violation that was not disclosed by the prosecutor. And I find that out because I asked for a fragile medical release because he had a heart attack. He actually died in prison and they recovered. He got a pacemaker. I requested for a medical release and she said, absolutely not. So I did some research and the detective was on the Brady list at the time. The argument now is proving that he was on the list at the time for this to
Will you
go
tell
anywhere.
everybody what a Brady list is? Because I was going to bring it up.
Okay, the Brady list is a list that law enforcement, judges, prosecutors, whatever, keep on law enforcement or people in law enforcement that says whether they're a good citizen or not, whether they're liars or dishonest or whatever. And if it compromises going to trial or to court or any kind of action, if they are on the Brady list, because you can say it has to be disclosed, or you can say, you can get the
Exactly.
prosecutor for not disclosing it. And that's where we
Yeah.
are.
I wish so another word for it, folks, is it's a blacklist for prosecutors and law enforcement that can't do what they're supposed to do, not following the rules or suppressing evidence or what have you. One thing I've always wished, I wish they did not name it Brady. I wish they would have named it something else, because I don't want everyone to confuse that with a Brady violation. It is two separate things. Two separate things. The names are the same. Okay. Brady violation is suppression of evidence. Brady list is just a blacklist, that they use, that it's a national list that is used to, keep officers
But they
set
don't
apart.
fire them? Like, if you
They
get put on the
it
Brady list, you
depends.
can quit being a cop, you can quit being a
It not
prosecutor, whatever.
necessarily. Not necessarily. So every state has its own, like here in Texas, they have what's called TCOL. It's Texas Council on Law Enforcement. Every state has a governing body that issues or gives the commissions for law enforcement for the prospective towns, cities, counties, or what have you, all the way up to state police. In order To get one, some, get an individual fired, obviously, and an executive like a chief of police, a sheriff has to fire them, and they have to file, with the state because all licenses, well, I don't want to say that because some states are different, but here the license is held at the state level for Texas law enforcement on down to the bottom. Okay. So, if there's an issue, you file it with them, and then they actually have investigators that are agents that work for the state government that go out and investigate these issues. And if they find an issue that is, reaches the level where they should be placed on a Brady list, they would do that. The whole reason it was created was to stop these officers from getting fired at one agency and moving to another agency and getting another job and then turn around and doing the same thing again. Okay. Is it a perfect system? Absolutely not. Okay. That is one registry, I guess you can say they don't watch too. Isn't that kind of ironic?
It really is. Yeah, we
Okay.
could put you on a registry, but when we
Exactly.
above you miss you know do bad things, won't do it.
Okay, I'm going to move on. We can talk all day about a singular issue. Okay, so we were talking about missing evidence and how law enforcement, prosecutor, judges, defense attorneys—it's both sides of the courtroom. They cut corners. Okay, I'm not playing a blame game. I'm not picking anyone out specifically, but there are cases, and I'm sure some of you can relate, that at least one of those people, if not all of them, have cut corners in cases. Okay, so you start to see decisions made for convenience, not truth. And what becomes clear is this: the criminal justice system doesn't always fail by accident. Sometimes it fails by its own design. Okay. We are told that once a conviction happens, the process is over. And I just heard that from the gentleman that asked me a while ago. Is there a time limit that you can file a post-conviction case? And no, there is not. The only difference between a trial and a post-conviction is the Constitution guarantees us a fair and speedy trial. Do y'all remember that verbiage? You remember it from social studies? Fair and speedy trial under due process of the law. Okay. Now, in the post-conviction stage, there is no such speediness. I wouldn't even say the trial part is very speedy, because they hold folks for 1, 2, 3, 4 years before they get to trial. It just depends on the scenario. But there is no expectation of time. You can file a writ and it can go to the appeals court or whatever equivalent is for your state, and they may sit on it. They don't have a time limit that they have to answer to it. The only time that there is a time limit after the original conviction is if you file your subsequent appeal, and it varies from each state. In Texas, you have 30 days to file an appeal, unless an extension is granted for a certain scenario. Okay. So with that being said, I've heard some states are 60 days, some are 90. It can go on up from there as long as you have a good excuse in need of an extension, right? It's like getting a teacher's note, a note from your mother to go to school late or whatever. But it just depends and it varies by the state. But that is the only time there is an expectation of time. Is when you're in that initial appeal subsequent to your original conviction. Okay.
But you could still do a
Once
writ of
you're,
habeas corpus later.
you can do one at any time. Yeah, you can do one
Okay.
at any time. You can
Can't
do
do an
one the
appeal,
same
but you
day
can
you
do a
get
writ.
arrested. Exactly. And a lot of states have what's called out of time appeals, meaning like I've had a case recently where the gentleman, he demanded, he told his attorney, I want to file an appeal. And he deliberately disobeyed him and didn't do it. Okay. So the lawyer
The lawyer
disobeyed the
disobeyed.
defendant.
Okay.
So automatically that resulted in an approved habeas corpus case. Okay. Because an attorney cannot make decisions for you. That goes back to Strickland violation we talked about. Strickland. I talked about the two prongs about reasonable defense, right? Okay. What that is called when an attorney does not do what they are supposed to do is called ineffective assistance of counsel. The Constitution requires effective assistance of counsel. We understand the difference.
And I assume this needs to be either recorded or in writing. You can't just say, my lawyer said this, because the lawyer can just say, no, I didn't.
Well, the way you fix that is do a sworn affidavit and make sure it has that clause in there, say, under the penalty of perjury, I say that this is all true, and then submit that to the court. That tells the judge one thing, that if you're willing to lie on a document and potentially get 2 to 4 more years of prison tacked on top, that, hey, you're probably telling the truth, okay? Or it's at least to get an evidentiary hearing going where, you know, where it, all those things can be brought out into the open, okay?
Yeah.
So, like I said before, we were told that once a conviction happens, the process is over. It's not necessarily true. And then we talked about pleas. Some states, do y'all know that in the plea agreement, there's real small writing that says if you agree to this plea, that you are admitting to guilt as if you did do the crime. And the state of Texas has this crazy thing in there that are there in all. It's almost like it's a generic form. They have a right to destroy all applicable evidence in your case.
If
so
she
guess
needs to sign
what
a plea, they can just destroy all the evidence.
It
oh my God.
Sometimes it's written in there. So think about this. Think about me, Robert, years later doing a post conviction. How am I supposed to work an investigation when all the evidence has been destroyed?
Wow,
makes
that's
it really
like almost
difficult.
Admitting it's almost like the
exactly
the prosecutors are admitting they're full of it.
Exactly. And let me tell you all this. Always remember this. You remember when I told you at the beginning that justice is a two-way street? Or maybe they didn't have enough to convict an individual on. They didn't have a good case. Just because they don't have all the evidence that they needed to get a good, clean conviction doesn't mean that that evidence is not important. We're not necessarily looking for the evidence itself, but the lack thereof, right? It's a two-way street, you know, because they're missing evidence, you know, that's suppressed, or the lack of evidence can show that there's no case. Most cases you have to prove intent, right? Every law is broken into elements. If all these elements here have to be met in order for this law to be charged on an individual, right? Okay, so if those elements aren't met, the intent can't be proved, right? So that's why they're quick to go to plea negotiations, because they can't do it. They're looking for numbers. They want percentage rates. That's all they want.
Yeah.
Okay. So, okay, we were talking about that once a conviction happens, the process is over. But those of, you know, the you that are in this meeting today know that that's only when the real fight begins, is after the conviction. Post-conviction is not about finding truth necessarily. I can't tell you how many people come to me and say, you know, innocent, here's the truth. It's not always about the truth in a post-conviction case. It's about defending a result, right? Because that result is what got you convicted. The result is what got you in prison. The result is what has to come under attack, right? You have to undo the exact item. Not saying that you can't introduce innocence, but it's always best to have other things with it. And that's constitutional errors and violations, just like we've been talking about. Okay.
Seem to be rampant. You know, I hear a lot of people saying, you know, this was awful, and you know, my prosecutor terrible, and my lawyer was terrible, and
So we're talking about, you know, post conviction, and it's not necessarily about finding the truth. It's about defending a result. And when the system shifts from seeking truth to protecting outcomes, people get left behind. That's exactly what happens. Okay. I've worked in cases where critical evidence was never disclosed, cases where defense counsel didn't investigate key facts, cases where narratives were built first and evidence was shaped to fit the same narrative at a later time. Do y'all realize that's how evidence tends to work a lot of times for prosecutors? And I'm going to bring up another term that some of you may have heard of. It's called a Denny suspect. Anybody heard of a Denny suspect? Okay.
Denny, like Denny's
so,
restaurant?
Well, just one N. No, but
one N. D-E-N-Y?
One N.
Okay.
So law enforcement, they, you know, they create narratives. They try to create theories of what happened when some, you know, when they're accusing someone of a crime. And, you know, there's a lot of conclusion jumping, you know, jumping to conclusion. And let's say we have a whole room full of evidence Some of it's good for them, some of it's not necessarily good for them, but they know they have their theory. A lot of officers do this not even realizing that they're doing it, but they get tunnel vision and they only go for the evidence that's in the room that fits their given theory. Some of them do it on purpose, but most officers, when they go through training, they go through investigative school. Even the people who work in CSI, just, they're technicians, they're not law enforcement. They're taught in certain scientific methods how to collect evidence in what fashion, but they're always instructed by a detective or an investigator or someone in charge what to do and what not to. Okay. So what kind of problem does that create? They collect evidence that only fits their theory, not evidence that could have showed that the person was innocent. And then it brings circle me back to the Denny suspect. A Denny, I guess you can call it any name you want, Joe, Dan, or whatever. It's an alternative suspect in a case. Police are always supposed to investigate alternative suspects. They can't just single someone out and stick with that person. They are required to explore all channels and all avenues as to who might have committed a crime. Do you think that's always true? Do you think they do that, or they're quick to jump to conclusions? They are quick to jump to conclusions. I see
How
people
do you, I want to
typing
look up this
something, but
Denny suspect. How do you spell, if I wanted to look up a Denny suspect, what would I
you can
type in?
just Google Denny suspect.
How do you spell it? Denny?
Denny. And you can just look up alternative suspect, investigative techniques, things like that. Because not all agencies use that term. That's just a national term that tends to be
Okay.
used. But everywhere you go, you got different names for different things. Okay. So we're talking about, cases with critical evidence that's never disclosed, cases where defense counsel didn't investigate key facts, cases where narratives were built first and evidence was shaped to fit the narrative later. And yet, cases move forward. Do you understand what I mean by that? Is that the system doesn't stop. It just keeps on going. Nobody says, hey, wait a second, we need to look at this again. Keeps on going. And I'm going to remind you all something, especially here in Texas. The state of Texas, and I know like a lot of other states, it doesn't matter if catch them wrong-handed, breaking the law, some kind of violation or something, or misconduct. They hate admitting fault. They do not like it. I'm sure a lot of people can relate to that or have heard of things of that nature. So I want to talk to you also, guys, about something else tonight. We already kind of touched on it a little bit. Something that affects families long after the courtroom has gone quiet. Some people are on pretrial probation. Some are out on parole and under constriction, restrictions that the court or parole board puts on them. And that's about what you guys are all about is registries. So that's what I'm talking about. We already talked about, how they relate to post-conviction. Post-conviction kind of is that first stage, especially if you are an innocent individual or you feel that your case was so infirm with so many constitutional issues, which is another violation, guys, called the cumulative effect, cumulative doctrine. That means when you have so many issues with your case that your conviction has become infirm and therefore under federal law it cannot stand. Okay? Write that one down. That's a real important one. Cumulative effect, cumulative doctrine. Okay? So for individuals with registries, for many the punishment doesn't end when the sentence ends. It follows them every day, every job application, every housing opportunity, every attempt to rebuild one's life, and not just for them, their family as well. For you, perhaps their mothers, sisters, fathers, grandmothers, daughters, any other family member. We're told and we're taught that, the registry system is all about safety. It's about safeguarding others, supposedly. Okay. But let me ask you something, and I want y'all to answer or, react back with me on this. Does a system that removes hope create safety? Okay. Does a system that blocks employment create stability? Does a system that isolates people make communities stronger? No. Or does it do the opposite? Okay. Because what I have seen, in these systems, they often trap people in a permanent state of punishment, a permanent state of punishment. No path forward, no real opportunity to rebuild, no recognition of growth, change, or their truth. And when a system refuses to acknowledge change, it stops about being about justice. Justice is gone. It comes all about control. And our government, you know, that our founding fathers set up some 250 years ago, did not set, our form of government to be about control. That is what we were trying to get away from, control. But I mean, you can look around today, everything that governs us is about control. I don't know if y'all agree with me on that, but it doesn't matter what politics you're in. I don't like to talk about that stuff too much when we were talking about this type of subject, but at the end of the day, it doesn't matter about the politics. It is straightforward. You know, we live in a government that is very controlling in all aspects. Okay. So what's the hardest part about all of this? You know, many of you already know, you've lived it. You felt the weight of it. You know, you've watched yourself or someone you love try to move forward only to be pushed back again and again. But here's what I want you to understand, you know, coming from me, you're not wrong in questioning the system. You're not wrong in questioning the criminal justice system. And that's what I feel that everybody in here is doing. Just meeting together, standing together is an act, you know, of questioning the system. You get in here, you talk about issues, and folks, that's what our Constitution is all about, is to argue, to come together, to understand, to share information, and become stronger, okay? You know, there are times I know that each and every one of you are feeling that something about your case or something that's presently going on about the registries, you know, that isn't right, that they're doing something that isn't right, that they're not allowed to be doing. You're seeing and you're experiencing it every day. It is very real. It has become a part of your life. So I wanted to talk to you guys about my book. It is The Innocence and the Illusion of Due Process, A Look at Post-Conviction. This is a copy of it. Oh, I don't know if it's going to.
There we go. Oh,
are funny. We blurry?
It was great for a second. And then all of a sudden, oh, it's because it wants to focus on your face. Maybe put it in front of your face. See if.
No.
Well, it's in the email everyone got when.
It's in the email.
It's in the email. And the link to purchase it from Amazon is the first thing I put way, way, way up at the top of the chat. Very first link was how to buy it. And my library lets you, there's a thing that called suggest a purchase. So usually I, instead of buying all the books, I ask the library to buy them because I figure then, you know, lots of people will get to read it and I don't have to store it for the rest of my life.
One thing I will tell you about the book, guys, it is perfect binding. It is paperback. And it is approved for most prison systems. So if you know anyone, if you order it directly from Amazon to a prison facility, like you have to have it delivered there, they will accept it. Okay. If you buy it and try to mail it yourself, it's kind of 50-50. It depends on where you're at. Okay. But it does meet all the standards for the national, you know, the national standards for receiving books. Okay. I will tell you that, you know, I wrote this book not as a theory. I know most people are tired of hearing about theories, what can or what wasn't. I didn't write it about theory. I didn't write it as an opinion. You know, I wrote it as a reflection of what I have seen over the last 17 years firsthand. Okay, that's how long I've been doing this, working investigations. 17 years, I've seen it firsthand every day. I talked about in the book what is real, what people go through. This book pulls back a very heavy curtain, okay? It shows how cases are built, how rights are blatantly overlooked, how procedures that are supposed to protect people sometimes fails them entirely. And I think that's where a lot of you relate here in this meeting. It talks about the illusion. The law is the illusion here, okay? And you might ask me, Robert, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by the illusion of law? We can have things written down on paper all day long. It doesn't mean it's going to be followed, you know. Or you can say it's being followed, but actually doing something else, okay? Just like we talked about earlier today about Brady disclosures. The prosecutor, when they're ordered by the court to hand over discovery, which is, police reports, any type of evidence they have in a particular case, the court orders the prosecutor to hand over discovery in the form of Brady disclosure. In fact, most of them even put a cover sheet on top of the evidence packet that says Brady disclosure. Everything is here. Every part of this case, I am now handing it over to, a lot of these prosecutors just committed another crime by signing that cover sheet and handing it over. They just lied on a government document because they already suppressed some evidence to withhold, and they lied on a Brady disclosure saying that all the evidence is there when it is actually okay. And this is how I know this, folks. I take work on a case and I go to the original defense attorney, and I say, hey, give me the documents, all of them, that the prosecutor gave you. And they do. And then I go to the prosecutor and say, hand me all of the discovery. Do you know that the media sometimes hand me evidence that they didn't mean to? What's that, Dave? Dave, you're muted.
Oh, hang on, let me find Dave. Dave. Okay, he's unmuted now.
Yes, I'm sure you're absolutely true about that.
Yep. They don't even know it. But here's the awesome thing about it is everybody. It depends on the jurisdiction where I live. Prosecutors are elected officials. Sometimes they're appointed. At the federal level, they're all appointed by the president. But here they're elected. And just like any type of government, people come and go and things change. People get voted out, new people get voted in. And when a prosecutor is leaving and a new one is taking over, they're not going to say, hey, on this case, don't hand this over because I withheld it. They're not going to tell each other that because they are required under the ethic laws in a given state and federal that they have to turn said individual in for suppression of evidence, and they can get prison time for, when they're purposely withholding evidence. So
So
in
are they
other
doing this
words,
just to get just because it's they're more concerned with their conviction rate than fairness,
yeah.
and they're not worried about getting in
Exactly.
trouble? Is no
They'll
one
do
getting in
anything
trouble
they
for this?
very rarely, very rarely. And you have to have a judge that's willing to do it.
And I
And
would
here's
suspect that
the issue with
a
that.
judge is covering their butts just like prosecutors are.
Yeah, because it is the court's duty to ensure that the prosecutor and defense attorneys are doing everything correctly. That is very broad terminology, being correct. Every rule, every law is being held accordingly. So to say that they did this kind of admits some type of shame on themselves, because they did not ensure that things were followed properly in their court. Miss Faye?
Yes, prosecutor's next step is to become a judge. My situation was they were being interviewed to be a judge, so winning our case was a big feather in the cap.
Okay, thank you for sharing that. That reminded me of something really cool I want to tell you guys. There's a case that I worked on. It happened back in the 90s. I remember the gentleman that came on earlier, he had mentioned his case was back from the 90s. This particular individual was prosecuted by this prosecutor in his prospective county here in Texas. And just like you said, Miss Faye, this individual later goes on to be a judge, right? Now picture this, all these years later, 30 years later, he does the post-conviction thing. He does a post-conviction case. And here's what I found out is most of the writs are done ex parte. Does everybody understand what that is? Ex parte. That means done behind closed doors, essentially, as it relates to writs. It's behind closed doors. Okay. Which I really like. A lot of people say, oh no, it's behind closed doors. A judge can do whatever they want. I kind of disagree. It gives the judge time. Again, there's no expectation of time for a decision. It gives them time to research and understand the arguments instead of trying to make a decision, on a dime in the middle of a courtroom with 100 eyes staring at you. You get what I'm saying? So it gives them more time to research. But this is what I found. when this individual was convicted back in the 90s by this prosecutor who later became a judge, when he appealed it, guess who was the judge that overlooked his appeal? The same guy that was his prosecutor. Same prosecutor about 10 years, or, he was already a judge at this point, but 10 years later was removed from the bench and put in federal prison for several things he did. Now, believe this man had the defendant, right? Had sat in prison all that time. All he had to do was file a very simple motion that the prosecutor and the judge is one and the same in my case, and therefore I request review. He would have walked home the next day. They were turning everyone loose that guy had ever touched, and he just didn't know any better. No one went to help him. Nobody knew.
That's right. Nobody wants to help you.
Whose job is it to sit there and go back through all the case? Nobody's. Nobody does that. Convictions is about finality, being final. Soon as you're convicted and you're locked away, it's final. You belong to the correction system now. Where you go from there is up to the correctional department and the parole board, if you're lucky to get to them. Okay? So I think Miss Francine, there she is.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
Hey there. I have a question. So
Yeah.
I th have thought many times about writing the judge that sentenced my son. He was 18, had consensual sex, and it was right at the time of the Me Too movement. And he missed
Okay.
that Romeo and Juliet clause by a few weeks.
Okay.
He's 28 now, but I've often wondered, can that judge, like, if I wrote to her or asked for a meeting with her, is there any way like anyone can ever help or not, that's not $200,000, for instance? I'm just wondering.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, which state are you in, ma'am?
I'm in Florida
Okay.
in the worst county, which is Seminole. It's a very tiny
Well,
county. And
I was going to say
it just pushed some real big law through recently.
when it comes to this subject, I always say better not be in a southern state. And I think everybody knows where I'm going with that. For here's something that I've always struggled with is most southern states, the age of consent are relatively low as in comparison to states up north. And as you relate it to federal law, federal government says the age of consent is 18. Okay. But the Constitution has this nice little clause where they say that states have what's called reserved rights. Everybody ever heard of that? Reserved rights, meaning that the states have the right to govern themselves. That's how all these states are getting away with having marijuana, for sale in the state. They can govern themselves, right? But back to the issue here. Federal government says age of consent's 18, and then each individual state has their own age of consent. Not sure what it is in Florida. Is it 16? Francine, did she
I think
disappear?
Francine messed herself back off. I'm gonna unmute her again.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you know what the age of consent is in Florida?
Yeah, it's 18.
Oh
Is
wow.
it 18? Well, that must
Yeah.
be changed. Well, here's where I'm going at with that. Here in Texas is 17, in Oklahoma is 16, in Arkansas it's 14, folks. Isn't that crazy that a
Wow.
14-year-old girl or young man can marry an adult at the age of 14 without parental consent and engage in sex
I
without
just know
parental
that it
consent?
happens from being a teenager.
It does. It
You know what I'm
does.
saying?
Well, I'm
That's
gonna
what I'm saying. It's
let me ask you
a
this,
predatory
Francina.
thing. It's just,
He was 18, and I'm assuming he just turned 18. How old
that
was
he
the
was
young?
it the girl was 14. So I kept saying to
Okay.
the lawyer, like, what about Romeo and Juliet? No, he would be on an
Yeah,
ankle bracelet. And he's like,
it
oh,
is.
there's four counts. He's going to go in for however many years. So you can either do 2 years in state prison or you get 60 months probation on the bracelet and, of
Yeah.
course, a lifetime on the registry in Florida. Well,
Well,
25 years at 51, he can, ask.
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that's rough. That's really rough. Let me explain to you how, and everyone else in the room, how Romeo and Juliet law works. As long as the older individual in the relationship is under 18, they can be a day shy of 18. they're allowed a 4-year age gap. The moment that oldest one in the relationship turns 18, it goes down to 3 years, right? And as he turns 19, it gets worse. You know what I mean? It is, it's like an algorithm. It just keeps getting stricter and stricter. But essentially, if he missed it by, like she said, a couple of weeks, he would have been okay.
Yeah, and I get it, but
What
it's
was
yeah.
the mom and dad of the female? Was she,
No,
were they
no.
the complainants, or they were
No,
just
the girls were talking amongst themselves at school, and a boy
And
overheard
they
them and went to
mandated
the guidance
report. Yeah.
counselor and said, "Hey, I
Exactly. Yeah.
think these girls are having sex with an older man." Well, it was my son,
Let me
and
guess,
even
CPS got involved.
It just blew up from there. It was on the news and everything. But even in the discovery, because I have the discovery and I've read it quite a few times, but they've even been like, he didn't do anything wrong. But as they go back and question them again and again, some of the parents wouldn't even turn over their kids' electronics, and I've
Oh, wow.
never been in the legal, yeah, but I'm in medical. My husband's a carpenter, and I'm gonna try to change this law or die trying. So that's, and they just
Yeah.
pushed through
Well,
whatever they were pushing through here in Florida,
I definitely
Senate
support
Bill
you on that.
212. Yeah.
I'm not going to lie to you. I understand that's an issue there where you're at. I can't tell you. I can't even count how many cases that I've had that are just like you just described to me.
And you know what?
And let's
So
face
there's.
it, an issue that tends to happen is, again, we're in an ever evolving world, social media. Our kids that are growing up now are not like the kids were when we were young. Okay. The dynamic has changed. And with that, moralities have changed. Okay. So you start to see these young people, that promote and do and to make videos and post on, social media and God knows what else. Y'all remember at the very beginning of this, I said that the Constitution and our laws are ever evolving. It's true, but sometimes it gets behind and it can't catch up to the present day. And we always tend to do that. 20 years from now, there'll be something in place to fix what happened 20 years ago, So
Yeah.
it just takes a
Yeah, like
while to catch.
when they realized that there were really harsh sentences for crack and not harsh sentences for
Oh,
cocaine, and
yeah.
eventually they were like, "Oh,
Oh, yeah.
that's not fair."
Oh, sure. I mean, even today, and I'm not trying to get off topic, but there's people that are in prison for life plus some for trafficking marijuana, but someone who killed someone is already out. I'm like, make that make sense. I'm not saying to go out and do marijuana, kids, but you know what I mean? But it's just, it doesn't equal out.
It
It
doesn't
doesn't
equal out.
compute for me.
No.
But ma'am, I understand, Miss Francine, I understand your issue there. It is a very common thing. I will say that you can write a letter. I don't think it will help. They will probably tell you to file habeas corpus or habeas corpus writ.
I
It's the
wrote
same. It's the same in all states.
I
You
so
do that yourself?
I wrote the judge a
Yeah.
letter, but like I've also, because I don't care what anyone's political things are or whatever. Ann knows me. We were in DC together. Like I wrote this administration, and they actually sent it to the pardon attorney, but because then they wrote back because it wasn't a federal crime, they couldn't help to go through the state. Well, of course, I've written DeSantis, and them till I'm blue in the
Yeah.
face, but with this new case that just has come down the pike in the past couple days here, it's really got me thinking, and I'm like, it's ridiculous for this to be public when you know that these are low profile people that never hurt anyone to begin with, and yet you're
Sure.
making them targets and allowing them to be hunted because
Did
of
he take
whatever
a
stupid
plea
rule.
or did
Yeah, hell yeah, he took a plea because it was the 4 counts, 15 years each count, so that's 60 years. So they said if it was 1 count, maybe we could have helped you, but he said you have to take this plea or you're going to go do 2 years in state prison. And he was 19 at that by that point. They arrested him
Yeah.
a couple weeks after he turned 19. So what
Okay.
decision would you have made? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, no one's going to. prison for that, but not knowing the ramifications of the sex offender registry.
I will tell you, in my shoes, it would all come down to what evidence that they had. If they had his
Well,
cell
he told the
phone from his,
truth. Yep. And he told the truth. I've raised my kids to, you know what I mean? I didn't know you should never speak. You know what I mean? That's how my mom's 87. She's like, that's how we raised you. I'm like, I know.
to tell the truth and be honest,
Got
I understand it.
effed in the
But
rear
people
for
always
it,
think that's
you
going to
know?
help them.
No.
Everybody in here, you just need to, the way things and the climate, the way it is now, it's just better just keep your mouth shut. Okay. When people start talking, that's when they start getting in trouble, or they take what you say and twist it to use it against you.
Yeah, he
Okay.
don't
And
talk.
that,
I'm only talking as a mother, you know what I mean?
Oh, I understand. The answer to your question, Anne, can she write a writ for him? She cannot. An attorney can. The only way that her son can do it, he can do it. It's allowed under the law, but he has to file what's called a pro se. Has everybody heard what pro se is? Latin for representing yourself. That has to be filed with the district court that or judicial court that he was convicted in, asking permission to represent himself. If they sign the order, which they will about 99% of the time, they will sign it. And then he will be given law library privileges where he can go in there and learn how to write it and just make sure. And this is not legal advice, by the way, but just make sure that he follows instruction to the letter. Because even if the writ is misformatted in the smallest thing, they can reject it. They don't care about
Wow.
the information in the writ. If it's got too many spaces in between, they can reject it. So make sure he follows the rules to the letter.
That's a writ of
Wow.
habeas. He's
Just look up
real
writ of habeas
smart.
corpus.
Yeah, he's real smart. Like, he's done a lot of research. You know, it tells me, oh, this will work or that won't work. You know what I mean? But I'm always on these calls because you never know who you're going to run into and what you might learn, you know?
Sure.
There's a lot of questions in the chat that we haven't gotten to. So
Thank you.
one of the people in the chat
Yes, ma'am.
asked if there's questions that we don't get to, would you be willing to, like, you know, answer them later?
Sure. I
One
don't have no
question that I
problem with that.
one of the questions I see in the chat is if an accuser or accusers at least informally, verbally recant their accusations and to more than one person following your conviction, can that be used in a habeas corpus effort? What about the tendency,
And
as in his state of Arkansas, for the LEOs and the court to allegedly ask the accusers, were you lying then or are you lying now?
okay, this is a big thing, and I work a lot of these. A lot of the cases that are sexual in nature are like aggravated sexual assault of a minor, things of that nature. Okay, a minor, it is really hard to use their recantation because the court is always under the impression that, I'm not saying all, it depends on the judge, but I'm just telling you what I've seen, is they think the child is being coerced. Isn't that funny and ironic again? They want to push the
Right, of
iron,
course,
the
you.
coercion there, but they coerce you and it's not a problem. But anyways, they tend to not want to take a recantation of a minor. Now, I have had these cases where said minor is now an adult, and therefore I don't need parental consent to question them, and I go speak to them as a now adult. And they admit that they were lying. Okay.
And that can be
That can
used
be
then now that they're
used,
an adult.
but both ways can be used. Again, it's up to the judge how to admit it. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure who asked that.
That was John. And someone asked about when did Brady happen? It looks like Brady versus Maryland was 1963. So that should predate
Yeah, it's
all of our
pretty old.
questions. It's old.
Yeah, it's pretty old. Yeah, I encourage everyone to do their research.
Read the book. Sounds like read the
About
book.
read the book. I have a little bit more, guys, and then I'll stop. So we talked about my book. It's about how procedures that are supposed to protect people sometimes fail them entirely. It talks about the illusion, the idea that because someone, something looks fair, that it must be fair, but we know better. This book was written for people just like you, for families, who have questions, for the ones who feel that no one is listening, For those who know deep down that something isn't right, but don't yet have the language to explain it. And here's the truth, that knowledge is power. Because once you understand how the system works, you start to see where it is broken. And when you see where it is broken, that's when you can get together and start to fight back. This is not just a book, it's a tool. See it as a tool, it's a voice, it's a way to take everything that you've felt, everything that you have ever questioned, and finally put it into a perspective. Okay, so I'm asking everyone here, if you ever felt like the system didn't tell the whole story, or if you felt that something was missing, or you ever watched someone you love struggle under a system that has never seems or seeming to let go, then you need to read this book. It's not for me, I use the proceeds from it to operate, to help individuals just like yourself, people in post-conviction cases that have issues. Read it for your understanding, for strength, and for the ability to stand up and say that, this isn't right. Because real change doesn't start in courtrooms. It starts with people who refuse to accept this illusion. And I'll leave you with this. And like I said before, I will take questions if they want to write me, and I'll give my email here in the chat just in a second. The system might, it may be powerful, but it is not untouchable. And the moment people begin to understand this system is the moment that it can change. Okay. So I'm going
Yeah.
to put my email.
Oh, I'm putting your email right now. Rob Roy 6,
Oh, is it? It's
306.
robray306@gmail.com. Only thing I ask everybody is please label them really good and explain everything in its entirety when you're asking me something, because I'll have to go back and reference it. And I have so many emails coming in. I don't want to get
I bet.
anybody mixed up.
I bet. All right, I also want to make sure everybody knows how to save the chat because there's a lot of good stuff in the chat. So if your chat is open, there's these three dots at the top. You click on those three dots and then it'll say save chat. And then after you exit out of the Zoom, that chat will just be sitting there and it'll be annoying. It won't be like pretty and colorful. It'll just black and white, but at least a way to get access. Yeah, honestly, the private profit for private prisons. You can't help but think that all these prosecutors and judges
Oh
know,
yeah.
we're filling prisons, so they gotta keep those conviction rates up. I have
Well, I'll
really
tell you
enjoyed
another
this
issue with
so
that.
much.
Another issue, thank you, ma'am. Another issue with private prison systems is if you do your research, you'll find out that most of the CEOs of these private prison systems are related to some senator, somebody high up on the chain. How do you think they get built within a given jurisdiction?
Yep.
They get the permits they need. You got congressional oversight on things like that. And guess what? Hey, I got a relative that runs these things.
Yep.
Yep.
That is the truth.
Big,
Yeah, when
the
all this
criminal
comes
justice
out.
system, guys, today is a money-making process. That's all it is. I'm sad. It's sad that it's come to that. But if everyone stopped committing crimes or traffic citations stopped tomorrow, the government would go broke, in a sense.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of these for-profit ones, they sign
Yeah.
the thing they sign says we're going to keep a 90% full or 80% full. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
absolute bullshit. I am
Most
really
cities,
looking
just so
forward
y'all
to.
know, most city governments are for profit. That's why we have problems. You ever heard of the term speed traps, and the states are cracking down on them? Speed trap is not on the civilians, it's on the police department. They set up speed traps to be able to write tickets because municipalities are allowed to keep 100% of their tickets that they write. Yep.
Well, I'm really looking forward to I'm gonna post the video to this one in some of the places where I know I've got a lot of people who are in situations just like ours. So this has been really
Okay.
great. I so appreciate your time. I appreciate that you wrote this book. I appreciate that you're willing to share this truth with the world.
Thank you, ma'am. I hope you enjoy the book, everyone, if you do get it. If you don't want to get it on Amazon, and you have my email address, I can send them directly to you. And if you want me to sign it, I will.
Ooh, that's exciting. All right, RobRoy306@gmail.com.
It's Rob
Thank you.
Ray,
This is
Ray.
Ray. Rob Ray.
Yep.
Did I spell that wrong? Let me make sure I didn't spell it wrong. I did spell it wrong. I'm fixing it right now. You're right. It's Rob Ray. RobRoy306@gmail.com. Okay, now resave the chat. And if I screw it up, reach out to me. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. See you in 2 weeks.
Have a good night, everyone.
Save the chat.